Mr. Henderson, Reel 17. We just begin to talk about your part and memories of the Falaise operation, or the Falaise Gap.
Yes. Well, the Falaise operation, for, I mean, people don't know what happened, but the Germans were getting pressed into a pocket. The Americans were sweeping round. We were coming, driving them forward. The Americans were coming round from our right, the Canadians, and driving them in, and they came right round to our left, the Americans, and the Canadians were on our right, and finally got them into a pocket. There was quite a few of them escaped, and I think we got the blame. The British got the blame for letting, I think, 40,000 get out. I think they said 40,000. Could have been 4,000, but I think it must have been 40,000. There was a lot got away before the gap was closed. It wasn't our fault. We would have been there if we could, but the Americans weren't quick enough. Anyway, we caught quite a lot. They did say there was 93,000 dead in there. How anyone can go and count that lot, I don't know. But the sentence, there was all sorts said. But when the pocket was closed and the tanks were lined up to start shelling, and it was a case of loading up, pulling the trigger, half an hour loading, half an hour sitting, pulling the trigger. There was no need to aim. It was just so you had a break while other two were loading, aiming, and firing, and that went on for about a week. Not you weren't doing it constantly, night and day, for 24 hours. I mean, you couldn't have done it. Your gun barrels would have got rid of for a start, but you put a lot of shells into that little pocket, and then that went on for a week, and then we had to advance, and the Typhoon aircraft were coming in and strapping, British aircraft, and then after a week we had to advance, and of course, being behind it, we had to go through it, so we saw we saw the result of what we'd done. While we were shelling, I think our thoughts were that we were probably getting a bit of our own back. But our men thought it was damned hard work. To load those things, you were very prone to get your fingers taken off if you weren't careful. It was a job I didn't like. So really, there was only one job. It was handing the shells up as well, and then another one loading, you know. And so when it was over, we'd lost quite a bit of sweat, working our shirts off, and then we advanced through. It was just a scene of carnage. I think Montgomery said that you could walk for 500 yards on rotting flesh. I think that's what his words were. It wasn't quite as bad as that, but there was an awful lot of dead horses, people in terrible states. I shouldn't say this, but we pulled up alongside a body, and my young brother wanted a belt, and I said to one of my crew, I want that belt for my young brother. So he was bloated up. He could have been dead a week. He was blue, and the maggots were crawling about all over him. But before this happened, we'd got a tin of corned beef. We'd stopped for lunch or whatever it was. And this other lad got a tin of corned beef, opened the tin of corned beef, put the corned beef on the rear mudguard of the tank, and cut it in half with his knife. When he's shaking it, it fell on top of this chap, which was just by the side of the track. And it fell on top of him, and he picked it up, and I said, I'm not going to eat that. And with bravado, he said, there's nothing wrong with it, and he ate it. I went and got another tin. But that was the sort of thing we were getting into a state where we were living like animals. It wasn't good. A lot of it was bravado, of course. Anyway, to get his belt undone with him being bloated, my friend had to stand on his stomach to get his belt uncoupled. You know, he had to stand on him. And then I took that belt home. I got that belt home to my brother with God mittens on the front, the German leather belt. And he wore it for years after that, and he had all badges along right round it. And I used to say, If you saw where that badge, that belt had come from, you wouldn't wear it. However, that was the scene in there. It was like a butcher shop. Vehicles, some bodies you couldn't recognise as bodies. They looked more like pieces of meat. There was one place just on the other side of the road from this chap that we'd got his belt, and there was a group of people on the about 20 yards into the... This was a potato field on the left, and they were laid all over the potatoes. And into the right, there was a group of people, and it was just like red meat. You couldn't recognise them, I don't think, as bodies. Dreadful. And then when we came out of there, we were going into the... It was in the evening.
Was this the time when you tell me that you even had to go over the bodies?
Yes. There was nothing else you could do. The road was covered. It was a potato field on our left. You couldn't go into there. You'd get bogged down, probably. You couldn't. You just went straight through them. And, of course, you went the first tank, the other tanks, and you just followed the tracks of the other. And as we came to the village of Falaise, I think it's a small town, but to us at that time it looked like a village. And there was two little children coming out of the village, walking into where we had just come from. And this would be maybe 5 o'clock in the afternoon or something like that. And that road, it was a long, straight, very, very straight, narrow road where all this carnage was. This would be all round Falaise, but this was our little place. And two little children, a boy and a girl. The girl would probably be 6 and the little lad would be about 4, hand in hand, walking out of Falaise into the carnage that we'd just come from. Nothing we could do. We just had to sort of... Someone would pick them up and look after them. As, you know... But that was something I saw that stuck in my mind.
Was there a lot of looting of bodies from, men stopping and getting things from bodies?
A lot of looting. Well, looting, of course, was frowned on, very much so, by... But when you saw any bodies, I don't think I did any looting off any bodies, but... When you saw a body, you saw if the infantry had been there first, which they normally were, you saw where they'd been looking at the pictures or the wallet, and the pictures were laid round the body. If a chap had a good watch on, no doubt his watch would be taken. And I think a lot of that went on. You can't blame if there's a dead body there, you can't blame a lad for taking a watch. It's no good to the chap that has it. But it seems a bit callous when you take a lad's cigarettes out of his pocket and smoke them. I couldn't do that, especially German cigarettes, anyway. But I believe some of them did that, if they were short of fags.
So now, in effect, you're starting the pursuit, which is, you say, moving towards...
This is the pursuit. This is where we got a bit of our own back, a lot of our own back. We just about knocked hell out the German army. There wasn't that many left. So we chased them to the Seine. This was our advance to the Seine. And we crossed the Seine at Vernon. Now, the Germans had blown the bridge at Vernon. So we came straight through the town centre of Vernon. And the bridge at the top of the town centre was down. It was quite a big... The Seine, it was quite a wide river. I think it must have been about 200 yards across. I'm only guessing at this. And your memory does play tricks, but I would think it would be somewhere about 200 yards across. So the engineers built a bridge, and I think the first people across that bridge were the Rangers, a Ranger battalion. I think it was from the 43rd Division. And there's a monument to the Rangers and to the... It was a recce regiment. 43rd Recce, or somebody. There's a monument there to the 550 lives lost making the Bailey Bridge at Vernon. And it was just small boats, and the tanks had to go across. And when you went to the other side, there was a high mountain range. Not a high mountain range, there was high rocks and trees, and the Germans had guns up there. And... That was pretty well shelled and bombed before we went on the bridge. But they were having a go at the bridge. But we went over there I think by that time they would probably just about had the chips up there. But I can't remember any hold-up once we got over. Now, that was about the 27th or 26th of August. My friend, Ron Hall, was killed on the 28th of August, and he's quite a decent way from the... That was a Breatloo. That's quite a canny way from the Seine. So we can't have been held up much. But the village, there was... And two Westminster Dragoons, Westminster Yeomanry, were killed. They buried alongside him. One was 17, one was 21, an officer. My friend was 20. The village before that was where Tommy Pink was killed, and the young lad that was a replacement, he was killed at Arthur Verner's, which is the village. And then there was another one of our boys killed in the village before that. So at each village, you were getting losses. And you left a trail of your friends behind as you carried through, which was, it's an awful thing.
These were the German rear guard.
Yes, yes. It was an SP that knocked out. It was what you were talking about, an SP. It was a German SP that knocked out Tommy Pink's tank. And another one of the, as I said earlier, you see the flash and you shoot at it. And it was another one of the same troop that put the... second troop that put out the SP gun. And it was near here where Montgomery had been made up to, within 4 or 5 miles from that village, where was Montgomery made up to Field Marshal at that particular time. And Rommel's headquarters was also not far. That was on the Seine. Wasn't too far away either. Near Vernon, not too far from Vernon, was Rommel's headquarters. It was a big... chateau.
Were the Germans mining and booby trapping again on?
They didn't have much time for mines at this particular time. We were starting to do now about 100 miles a day. We were doing some fast riding, unheard of with tanks, because and the infantry, of course, were travelling by vehicles. We joined then by the 15th. Scottish, who were also involved in this, and it was fast flowing, heading up towards Brussels.
Were you getting receptions now from the village?
We're getting reception at every village, because the Germans were going out and we were coming in, and there was no fighting for the village. It was a marvellous time. This was so different from what we'd been. This was a relief. It was like a breath of fresh air to us. This was. We're getting a little bit of the perks of war. Well, before we'd been doing the brunt of it. It was nice to see the people welcome us into the flying the little flags. And the Belgians used to shout "La Libre Belgique" or "Liberty to Belgium," I think it was. And of course, when we went into Brussels, that was really something.
We'll do that in just a short while. Were you coming across the French...
Underground
people?
Yes. There was a bit of a pain. You would find one particular instance, there was some French Mackie, we called them. They used to come up with these black Citroën cars with a couple hanging on the side, asking for benzene. And you'd give them a couple of cans of benzene. And they had bandoliers that were like pirates, that big bandoliers of things and a rifle on the shoulder, benzene. And you give them a few tins of that and off they'd go. And then there was one case where there was some French Mackie in a field, in a wood, and some more in another wood. They were fighting each other. There was no coordination. They were lunatics. They were a pain. But they did a good job, especially in Paris. They knew, there wasn't, I don't think many people got away from Paris. They knew who the villains were, and that was a good thing.
Did you see any of the ladies who'd been to the Germans having their haircuts?
When we went into Amiens, there was a couple of ladies on a sort of a platform, as I remember it. I don't know what it was, whether it was something, it was raised up, I don't know what it was. and they were sitting on chairs getting all their hair cut off. These had been fraternising with the German soldiers. Camp Leon, I suppose, they were good looking boys, and they would have money, and they would have food and things. Anyway, they were getting the hair cut off, and the colonel, the Earl of Faversham, went and had a word with the people to tell them to stop, which they did do. But as soon as we'd gone, they would do it again. And but we stopped just outside Amiens that night. Of course, this is the area we knew was the First World War. This was the area we'd heard about. And Lille, Lille, I think, was beyond Amiens the next day. And there was snipers on the top of the pit heaps. That was a mining place. And we were trying to get the tanks, the guns raised to bring them down. But at Amiens we stopped that night, and I had the usual tin out, and we'd warmed the water, and I'm having a wash with my shirt off. And the young girl, from she was about 14 or 15, from the farm at the entrance of the field, came, and I asked her to wash me back, or she asked if she could wash me back or something. Anyway, the next thing, she was washing me back, and then she took me and my friend down to her house, where her mother met me and her father, and they gave us a glass of cognac and made us very welcome in the house. And the mother brought a coat out, a jacket, that was bloodstained and covered in machine gun bullets, and asked why did we not come 2 days sooner. Her son had been killed. And I said, well, you know, had we come 2 days sooner, it would have probably happened 2 days before that. You can't win. But anyway, it was sad that 2 days, this was a French Mackie, had they kept quiet, he would have still have been alive. But they were a bit mad, you know. Can't blame them, really. I think the same thing would have happened in England after they put up with that for 4 years.
Did you have any tough fights on the advance through to Belgium? Did you have pockets or areas where you had to fight pretty hard?
Not really. No, it was pretty quick right until we got into Holland. Belgium, wait a minute. The Albert Canal. At the Albert Canal, that was after Brussels.
Can we deal with Brussels before we get there?
Yes.
As you say, you've mentioned Amiens, Lille, and of course you go into Brussels, where you said the scenes of enthusiastic welcomes were getting heavier. Going into Brussels, what are your memories?
I remember it just like a sea of faces looking up at you and waving and cheering, and a path, a line of British vehicles going through this crowd of people, and they were saying, for God's sake, don't stop, you'll never get away if you stop. And they were climbing on the tanks, and they were cheering and waving and kissing everybody, and they were all round the front putting apples and bottles and things in among your feet. It was a terrific welcome. We had to keep going. We would have loved to have stopped there that night. I think if we'd stopped there, we would have been wined and dined and treated very well. We would have got anything we wanted, and it would have been nice. But we weren't allowed to stay that night. And what we did do was to pull through Brussels to a place called Louvain. And at Louvain, there was a monastery. And we stayed in the monastery, in the grounds of the monastery. That night, not a monastery, a convent. We stayed in a convent at Louvain.
How did your tanks maintain their progress over such a long distance, along roads?
Very well. They were fantastic, you know. I don't know what miles would have done by then, but there were new tanks, you know, there were new vehicles. In a lot of cases, just being given to us just before we sailed, some of them. Other ones would come from Fort George. They were the old ones. C Squadron tanks were older, but the A and B Squadrons were new tanks. They were very, very reliable. Very, very reliable. We had to keep our tracks in good shape. It was like looking after your, like your shoes, because they were called shoes, the tank tracks. And you had to replace tracks and things like that. There was one case where the rubbers, like a rubber, where the bogey wheels ran, got worn, and they all seemed to get, and they had to be replaced. Well, it wasn't a long job. They started to go. But mechanically, no problems. So it was, I mean, it was only June, July, August. Only 3 months.
Before we move on again into Belgium and coming upon more action, of course, what I forgot to ask you was the chances you got. We've talked about short rests. Did you get an opportunity to get a longer rest where you actually moved into one of the towns or cities and enjoyed their
facilities? No.
I'm thinking of the whole campaign now, you know, from
yes.
Normandy onwards.
No. We'd had a rest there at that little place. Now, just after Brussels, we got another rest. I forget the name of the little village, but we were in a field adjacent to a pub, and we were there for a week, and it was a lovely week. That was a good rest. That was a nice rest. We didn't have to go burial parties, and we didn't have to go to the FDS, and we had a nice week. The only thing we did do there was that there'd been some infantry or some German infantry seen somewhere, and we had to surround this place shoulder to shoulder with rifles and all night. We never found anybody, but we'd stayed awake all night waiting for these and dying to have a shot at these rifles, but nobody came out. And we moved in next morning, we covered right through, looking, but whether it had been a false alarm. That was the only place thing I remember. We were acting as infantry, dismounted tankmen. We were infantry for this particular job. We didn't find anybody. We were unhappy about that after being awake all night. But that was a nice little rest because there was two sisters at the pub, two young girls. And the name of the girls were Hart, Wilhelmina and somebody Hart or something like that. And all the girls, all the chaps in the troop and that all thought the world of these. And we used to go into the pub and we had a nice week. And they got a chance to do the oil changes and things in the tanks. And we felt good at this time. The sun was shining.
Had the mail kept up with you all the way?
All the way. We didn't get it every day, of course. Sometimes the mail would arrive a week and you probably might get five or six letters all at once. But at that particular time, I was writing to five girls, which was rather difficult, you know, when it came to the end. And we used to just send these little cards, I am dead, I am not dead, I am wounded, I am not wounded, I am in good health, I am not in good health. And you just ticked what was applicable, and there was no stamps, you didn't have to use any stamps, and give it to the post corporal, who was called Pinocchio. That was his nickname, Pinocchio, a little oldish chap, who did a marvellous job. He came up at night, always at night, and how the hell he found us, I don't know. But, so did the Nafi ration. Now, I don't remember ever buying any Nafi ration, but we got 50 free issue cigarettes. And we also got cigarettes out of our compo boxes. So we never really went short of cigarettes. We got cut off once for 5 days. We're coming up to that now, where we were cut off.
Well, we can deal with that when we get to it.
Because after this, there was a big push. We went up into a finger where the front line was, and we were right at the tip of the finger. And then they cut the finger behind us, and we were stranded for 5 days.
And we'd reached the Albert Canal, you were saying.
Yes, we got to the Albert Canal.
What happened to you there?
And in the morning, The Hitler Youth, there was all soft vehicles at this particular place, an RHQ.
You remember the place?
No, I don't. It was on the Albert Canal. But anyway, in the early hours of the morning, out of the trees came all these Hitler Youth. Mortars started dropping, and God knows what. One chap, when I left Barnard Castle, there was four of us left. One of these was one of the four. It was a little Welsh chap. Can't think of his name. He was killed there with a direct hit from a mortar. And after the action, which was only very, very brief. I mean, imagine little infant, little 15-year-olds coming out of trees. Of course, as I've said before, they can a bullet fired by a 15-year-old is just as lethal as the one fired by a 25-year-old. And they were absolutely fanatics. Well, I remember one of our fitters, Darky Harris, who now has a farm still alive somewhere down near Bath. He caught one of these lads, and he was a rough lad, was Darky, and he put him over his knee and he walloped his backside till the lad was kicking and screaming and crying. And that was one thing I remember about that. But they took five of ours, they captured five of our boys, one lad from Darlington. That was the lad that Harry was the chap that found an old car to put his mate on and wheeled him for miles until they were finally split up, went to two different camps and never met again. But that was the Albert Canal. Oh, but they also set alight to six of our soft vehicles. I think it was six that were set alight, ammunition vehicles and ration vehicles, petrol vehicles. The vehicles that kept us supplied. Six of those, I think, were set alight. But, of course, they're easily replaced.
How did you fight your way across the canal? Was it defended strongly?
No, that was easy enough. These canals are only very narrow, and the bridge was intact. We went over there, no problem at all. And we were heading then up towards the bridge too far, the Arnhem. There were an action. We're coming now to the what's known as Market Garden into Holland.
We're into September now.
Yes, you're coming up to this point. This must have been before the bridges. It has to be, I think. Where we were short of rations, we were cut off, and we'd made some sort of an attack to get rations.
Had you actually seen the flights of aircraft taking the parachutists into Arnhem?
Yes.
Had you known it was going to take place? Well, was this a surprise for you?
There was one after that as well. Appledorn was another bridge. The bridge after Arnhem was Appledorn. There was Grav Eindhoven Bridge, Nijmegen Bridge, Arnhem Bridge, and Appledorn Bridge were the five bridges we had to take. The Americans took Grav Bridge, the British took Eindhoven Bridge, the Americans took Nijmegen Bridge, airborne, and then the British were supposed to take Arnhem Bridge, but they were dropped, in my opinion, a week too soon. We never got a chance to relieve them.
Were you told how urgent and important was that you fought your way through?
Yes. But we were held up between Nijmegen Bridge. They tried to blow that bridge. They'd sent some infantry. They blew it, in fact, while I was on it. I was the third vehicle behind, and the first vehicle was turned over. It was a jeep. And then there was two tanks behind. The jeep was turned over and they killed, and the motorbike was just going past. It was the Galuli, the provost sergeant, was just going past, who was a pig. And I just must have looked away, and he's going back the other way. That motorbike must have... I don't know how he got turned so quick, but one minute he was passing me, the next minute he was going past the other way. And that was on Nijmegen Bridge. We never got a chance. There was a lot of fighting between the two bridges. They were very determined.